to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 247. I am Vincent Diamante, currently back from damn near 2 weeks in Japan, because I've spent nearly 2 months in Japan this entire year. I'm getting tired of the travel. I don't know. I cannot get used to the travel. I actually spent the last week just dealing with jet lag. I know that other people on this call have been dealing with the exact same thing, and I wonder how you guys are dealing with it. Like Alex. Alex, you were just in Australia, and that's even worse than the Japan-California divide that I had to deal with bridging. How are you doing?
I'm quite fine right now, but in about 90 minutes, you'll see me turn into a pumpkin or something equivalent as I gently nod off. So if I go quiet during this recording, then you'll know exactly what. Well, actually, we've got the cameras on today, so we can see each other. So now the pressure is on. I have to stay awake. No, I'm doing very well, thanks. Yes, I've just come back from 2.5 weeks of a lovely summer/winter holiday in Australia, visiting my family, and it's wonderful to be back on the show and back with you fine gentlemen.
Ooh, yes, always fun. This is always a great time, especially when we get the whole gang together, including Mike. Oh, wait a minute, Mike, you were in Australia. You did not cross paths with Alex, right?
Right. I was in Sydney, and Alex was much more likely in Adelaide. All three main panelists have recently made transatlantic flights over the Pacific and battled with jet lag in our own special way.
If it makes you feel excited, I'll be going to Australia in about 5 weeks.
Who's that voice?
Well, oh, that's true. I guess I'm jumping the gun. You can edit this out.
Just have
a reaction to nothing. Just keep your part, your reaction in, and then you'll just sound like you're hearing voices.
Oh, no, we're doing it live. We're doing it live. I'll go ahead and make this introduction. We have a guest today. He is a fantastic musician, a fantastic composer for games and movies, and he's been doing a whole lot of fun stuff recently, including a game that we're going to talk about later called Stray Gods, which should be out right around the time this podcast is dropping. So without further ado, Austin Wintry, how are you doing today?
Very well. And hello, friends. It's fun to do this again. Feels like 1,000 years ago. In fact, I'm trying to think when
it's
we
definitely
will have
been
seen
a while.
Each other even in person. Yeah, like it's been an eternity, seemingly.
I feel like we talked about an Assassin's Creed, though I couldn't tell you which one, and it might have been a historical review of your work in the franchise, but I knew that was on the docket during the prior interview.
Oh, well,
the AC that I worked on came out in 2015. So, if that was a new release then does this, have you been doing the podcast for that long? I mean, 200 some odd episodes is no joke. So I guess so.
Yeah, we're not exactly consistent with the release schedule, but we are, we definitely got longevity going for us right now. 247 episodes is a lot, and we're glad to have you on for yet another episode here.
Thrilled to be here. When did you start this? Like, what date approximately was episode one?
Was that 2014 or 2015?
I think it was a bit...
That's a good question.
Might have been a bit earlier than that.
Wow. Didn't we do our 10-year anniversary episode, like, last year? Why don't
I remember
any of us
last,
know this?
The last time I met Austin in person, Entree, sorry.
I love it. Just like saving time, compressed
right.
it all together.
The last time I met Austin in person was when we recorded the show at GDC, And that was, I think, in 20...
Oh, right.
Was that 2013? No, 2012? Somewhere 2013? It was about 9 or 10 years ago the last time I met Austin in person. So
that is nuts. Yes. I can't believe it's been that long.
I think it's Vince's is racing through a quick, subtle, stealthy check of records.
I am. It is.
He has that abstracted look, like he's doing math in his head.
Even though it was a decade ago ish, I still you're still the reigning champion for the most novel way to meet someone, just in general, Alex, because of the fact that we were independently asked if we were the other person at some GDC. In my mind, I've mythologized that so much over the last 10 years that it was like 50 different people. We're just like nonstop getting harangued. Are you Alex Smith? Like, I'm sure it was one person and it was at like a game audio event. So there's multiple sort of filters, but I just had never had that happen before. And the fact that it was reciprocally happening or happened to you, like I said, I've built it up in my mind and I kindly hope to retain my fantasy.
for those who are not aware, Austin and I have a slight resemblance. And when I was at GDC,
I think it's literally own glasses. I think that's right. I think that's pretty much all it took.
Yeah, I enjoyed my 15 minutes of fame there, being the composer of Journey, just for a little bit, and then people worked it out. They looked at the name badge. So I always turn the name badge around now, so people don't see. I loved your work on Journey. Thanks. Yeah, that was a tough one.
That's so funny.
Anyway, so Vince, what's the result? How long have we been doing this for?
I mean, it is 9 years actually.
Oh, no, 9 years. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, so you better start thinking about that 10th anniversary.
10th anniversary. What are we going to do for that?
I don't know.
Obviously have Austin back. I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
We'll just the whole time.
We need to find doppelgangers.
Pose as the other.
I know I've got a doppelganger somewhere.
Isn't Michael Shapiro a famous baseball player in the USA?
Isn't there the other Michael Shapiro composer that we could probably...
There are way too many for my comfort.
A friend of mine, I have a composer buddy named Jeremy Beck, who had to contend with the fact that there was also another Jeremy Beck composer. And I just remember thinking, that's kind of a novel name. And the fact that of the few people in the world with that name, two would wind up as composers struck me as preposterous. And both were concert composers. It wasn't even that, you know, one did film and the other one did concert music or something like that. They even were in each other's sandbox. But there were 20 plus years age difference. So my buddy had to christen himself as Jeremy Howard Beck, give himself that nice stately regal quality to help with the SEO, you know?
Elder also works. There's a nice regal quality to Jeremy Beck.
Well, the elder would be the other guy.
Oh!
So okay. he would have been the younger.
it still has a regal quality.
Jeremy Beck, whippersnapper.
Our own Mike is G, so he's the seventh. So there's six others, apparently. He's model G.
I used to bemoan my middle name when I was a kid because it was also the name of a well-known character from Sesame Street. So there was a little bit of a juvenile stigma with it, but I really came to appreciate it as I was mistaken for so many other Michael Shapiros in music. There's a drummer who's known for his polyrhythms. There's a producer who has terrible credit problems, as I've learned, and just a wide assortment of different people with my name. So yeah, middle names are treasured in my case.
Always got to love the leave it to the imagination about how you know about his credit problems.
Well,
let's just say I've gotten phone calls.
I was going to say, we can guess, yeah.
Well, let's see. We've got the one and only Austin Wintory here. So I think it would be kind of neat to talk about some of those early days, honestly, because as much as by which I mean, you know, you, Austin, and myself have been working in games and audio, you know, we're kind of connected a little bit through through some shared collaborators, and I'm specifically referring to that game company and Genova Chen and all the games that have sort of come out through there, like from that creative tree there.
You were definitely the sort of ground zero of my career beginning. You were right at the kind of spot, right at the forefront. I've basically known you for the entire, like, every minute that I have had anything resembling a career. In fact, you're just about the only person I can think of that I could say that of. I suppose the only other person would be that the first person that I met when I moved to LA was a film director who lived. When I first moved here, I got an apartment in Los Feliz, and the day I moved in, I met the guy that lived above me, who turned out to be a film director that I still work with. You know, we just recently finished, I think, our sixth feature together, and we've done other random things through the years, and we were just really close friends. And I happened to meet him literally on that first day, but it was only a month or two later that I met Genova. And I met you. I don't remember. Actually, can't even remember the actual literal first time we met. But it couldn't have been much removed from that, because you guys had already done Cloud by the time I met Genova. And so the seed, you know, the foundational components of all of that tree, as you mentioned, were already there. So yeah, that would have been 2006, early 2006.
Right.
So a couple years more and that'll have been 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's really kind of crazy that, especially seeing in games, because I sort of approached the game music thing very much from the games angle. I was so aware of the fact that anyone working in games generally flames out after a certain time. Like my teachers, my cohort, they were saying, oh, if you could have a career that lasts 5-6 years in games, you have a really solid career there. And then maybe you'll go on to something like, I don't know, a better paying job at Adobe or Microsoft or something like that. So I was coming at it from that angle. And yet it seems like now all the people that I know that have been working in games and in music and audio, they're people that have these really wonderful careers where they can look back and say, oh yeah, that was a really cool thing. And that was a really cool thing too. That, you coming at it from more that music perspective, did that ever cross your mind while you were setting foot into the games world?
Well, it's interesting because as time has gone by, it's really dawned on me just how lucky and right place, right time it truly was for me, like on a level that is just mind-bogglingly narrow edged. And specifically, not just obviously the chance of meeting Genova and meeting that director, for example, and a few other folks that I met that really were just absolutely instrumental in those early opportunities, those first things that my career wouldn't exist, at least in its current form, without having had those moments. But even just aside, just the age that I was, the receptiveness to certain ideas that I was, for example, I had originally applied to go to USC out of high school, which would have put me there in 2002, I think, 2003, something like that. And I got into the university, but the music program turned me down. The composition program turned me down. I was sort of invited to come as an open, undeclared major, and then essentially reapply, which is preemptively committing to a 5-year college experience. But I had applied to a few programs, and NYU had accepted me into their composition program. And so I decided, well, to hell with that. I'm not going to go where, I'm going in knowing I'm already sort of looking at an uphill climb. And I was so eager to kind of get to chase my dream that school itself, I kind of was like, Oh my God, 4 years already feels like an eternity. By the end of high school, I just kind of wanted to just move to LA and just sort of plunge in. But I decided to, I had been primarily self-taught up to that point. So I thought I should probably get a proper education. And so I decided to go to NYU. But after a year at NYU, I was quite convinced, okay, I gotta get to LA. It's very clear that the industry, the things that are in New York are just fundamentally not what I'm looking for. There's essentially, Broadway, indie bands, and advertising. Those are the, if you want to work in music as a composer, like you're a record producer producing indie bands that don't make anything that anyone's ever heard of. You're doing commercials, which is the most soul sucking, unbelievably just painful work. There's also independent films and things that are just a bottomless well of sadness and cynicism, very cliche New York pervasive attitude of just hating everything about the world. And so I grew tired of that culturally and pragmatically pretty fast. And so 1 year into NYU, I applied to be a transfer to USC on the whim that, maybe second time would be the charm. Despite the fact that they told me straight up, we don't really take transfer students because it's a 4-year program designed very sequentially, and we don't really like to kind of bring someone in halfway through where we don't really know what you know. And, it's really designed as a 4-year unit of time, not, 4 1-year units of time that, or something like that. I applied anyway, and to my complete astonishment, I got in. So I had to serve out the rest of my second year at NYU and then transferred. And it's precisely because I was sort of an outsider coming in after 2 years at that time that things like I never lived on campus. I never had like a normal college kid kind of experience there. I just got an apartment and that led to meeting different kinds of folks. And also I had to take one class that normally probably you would have taken as a freshman, but it was a degree requirement. I had to get out of the way, which put me in the men's choir. And I met a guy who was a classmate of Genova's at that, and he's the one who introduced us. So like, if I had come as a freshman, all of that would have played out so differently that it's literally, I can't even begin to guess what my life would look like right now. It's like, it's such a butterfly effect of a small moment that fully can all after the fact events can be attributed to, or at least a direct consequence of. Crucially, the thing I kind of led with about just even being the right age was something about living in New York, kind of, I think, accelerated my appreciation for the world. It's like I kind of grew up at a faster rate after 2 years in Manhattan than had I been living a sort of cliche college student life in LA. And so the result was I came looking for things of more sort of depth and nuance than I might have been otherwise, which was exactly where I needed to be in life to even understand what the hell Genova was talking about when he first showed me Flow, for example. Like, because if I, high school aged me, even just a few years earlier, that would have been perplexed, I think, by that, because games, it was just so not emblematic of games from where I stood. But I was sort of exactly at the right moment where I thought, oh my God, this feels like a glimpse into the future of this art form of just expanding the possibilities, not so much changing the dominant expression of the art form, but just, we're going to widen this umbrella, I think, or at least people like him. If I had seen that much younger, I probably would have been like, I don't know, I might've just written it off as pretentious or something like that. But instead it was so exciting because I thought, this is beautiful. Never mind, my God, if only you could have seen my face when I saw Flower for the first time. I remember being shown it in a hotel room at GDC where it was pretty far along. And I was like, this ratchets all of that up to like 1,000-fold. I mean, it was all the more affirmation that this group of people has a real insight into what gaming really could be relative to what it is at that moment. It really shaped who I am in such a crucial way that it like freaks me out when I sit and think about if I had just moved to LA at a slightly different time. It's literally like that movie Sliding Doors where where, you know, down that path, I like die by the time I'm 25 or something, because it just, the world would have been so different that it's like, what's even the point?
Up to that point, what was your experience with games and game audio as a consumer and as a player up to that point where you met Genova?
I was always a super ravenous gamer from my earliest memories. I don't even really remember when I started gaming. I jokingly always say that those memories kind of go over the event horizon of my consciousness, because I have no earliest gaming memory. It's just like omnipresent. It's like, what's the first time you remember eating? I don't have an answer to that. Music, on the other hand, started very distinctly in a chance kind of moment when I was about 10 years old, on a whim, starting piano lessons and very quickly taking an interest in composing, because I wasn't that interested in being a pianist for its own sake. But I didn't think to combine it with gaming really until much later, because it was keenly aware, like for example, growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, I very quickly became obsessed with the LucasArts point-and-click adventure games, that whole catalog of Day of the Tentacle and Maniac Mansion and Loom and the Monkey Island games and Full Throttle and The Dig and Grim Fandango. I just thought all of it was amazing. I just loved them all. I loved that genre in general. Like, I loved the Sierra ones as well, but the LucasArts really spoke to me. It's just for their style and one of the only games that had any sense of humor, really. They were so, it's still really rare. And so I, of course, quickly learned the names Clint Bajakian, Michael Land, and Peter McConnell as the sort of trio of in-house all things audio, and would read interviews with them where, you know, you read about the work that they were doing from an audio technology standpoint, separate from the fact that they were writing the music and doing the sound design and you know, things like, I remember Clint, actually this was from a personal story Clint told me, but it probably would have been in an interview somewhere around those days, where he was, you know, they rented a Harley Davidson and put it in the lobby of the ILM building at the Proscenium in San Francisco to rev the engines to record it for sound design purposes on Full Throttle, you know, that kind of thing. So I was very early on, guys like that were heroes of mine, because I just thought, that's how cool is that? But it also became this, the takeaway was, if you want to work in games, you got to go get a 9-to-5 job at one of these companies, you know, and the dream would be to go work at a LucasArts, or like, I was, you know, really into Blizzard games at the time, and I was really into the Command & Conquer franchise, Westwood. Like, there were a handful of studios where I thought, I guess if I want it, but don't they, you know, there's like one music person essentially on the staff. I don't see them going anywhere anytime soon. It just, the whole thing struck me as highly impenetrable. And meanwhile, in parallel to all that, I had developed this passionate love for composers like Jerry Goldsmith and John Williams and you know, James Horner and then, you know, the earlier generations, Bernard Herrmann and Elmer Bernstein and et cetera, et cetera. And the whole Hollywood thing was very much a freelancer world. There was no staff work. And I thought, well, my dream would be to do both, but you really can't. You kind of have to pick one, because you're either a freelancer or you're not. And by dumb luck, kind of right around the time I got out of school, that really changed. And freelancing became the norm, you know, very fast around that, you know, the year 2000 and beyond. You know, things just kind of started to change. And obviously Vince as an excellent example, or people like Darren Korb, there are folks who have managed to sustain excellent composing, like, opportunities and careers from a staff position. But it became quite rare, which was lucky for someone like me who, you know, found, like, that was never very appealing. I thought, of course, the other part of it I'm leaving out is that there was a big chunk of time where I thought maybe I would want to go into game design. And I started taking C++ and HTML and Java and things like that classes in high school to try to get a foundation for programming. And then when I reached this crossroad where I thought, well, I probably have to commit to this or composition, because I don't know that you can really do both. Of course, I hadn't met Vince as evidence that one can, but I was quite sure that it was going to be unavailable to me. And I thought, well, I'm a lot better at music and I like writing music way more than I like coding. So I bailed on that. But I did have this period in high school where my fantasy was to make my own games and score them, and as something that I would have sprung from after having been just a sort of normal, part of a game developer, presumably as a programmer.
Is that something that you might entertain for the future? Like the idea of, I guess, kind of doing what I'm doing, which is making a company as a vehicle for your own music, which is sort of what I've done, I suppose. But is that something something you might entertain for the future, starting your own company?
I mean, I've flirted with the idea, but I've also been lucky that there's been enough opportunities on a consistent basis that I'm sort of regularly distracted by things that are exciting that I'm earnestly grateful to have in front of me, not least of which I mean this latest, I'm not changing the subject, but this Project Stray Gods is an example of one where somebody approached me and said, what would be your bucket list kind of game to do? And I said, well, I always thought it'd be cool to do a musical that's predicated on interactive musical numbers. And they were like, the person asking me was like that. It was a game developer, a guy named Ken Wong, who had just recently shipped Florence and before that Monument Valley. And he was like, I am not the guy to make those games, to make a game like that. He goes, a musical sounds like a horrible thing to me. But but I have a friend who's actually on the hunt for a collaborator who's setting up a studio with exactly that ambition. Just like crazy dumb luck. And he connected us. And so it was like, I didn't have to go to the trouble of setting up a company to do this thing because I happened to meet this dream producer and studio head, this guy, Liam Essler, who had that same ambition. And I met before they had really gotten it off the ground. This was 5 years ago. And it was like, well, let's freaking build it. So that has, in the interim, has scratched that itch of like someone quite literally asked me what would be a bucket list project. And then it kind of materialized almost serendipitously. But I do think about it. I do think about, you know, I remember once, years and years ago, like this was before Journey came out. I had a friend at Activision who invited me to put my hat in the ring on one of the Call of Duty games. And it would have been one of the last World War II ones before they took a break on that for a while. Like, this is before Modern Warfare. I can't remember which one it was. But I remember I had this pitch where I thought, I have family members who were World War II veterans. And I got to hear stories about, like, being in the literal Battle of the Bulge. And I always thought, you know, the thing that I can never stop thinking about in that context, and which I thought Band of Brothers has really been the best at highlighting, was that this was a war fought by teenagers, or really young, early 20s. You know, the overwhelming number of these millions and millions of soldiers were kids, so many of them from, you know, rural communities and like sort of quiet lives, now rushing out of troop transports onto the beach of Normandy, that sort of thing. And so I remember when talking to the Activision people, I said, imagine if we were to try to kind of surrealize this and we wrote like 40s big band music and put it through this filter of what would have been in their consciousness 1 month earlier? What would their life have been defined by in this very normal way? Like, what would their pop music have been? That kind of thing. What music would they, you know, would a young guy play for a girl he's trying to impress? That kind of perspective. But it was funny because I remember, you know, it was very obvious within about 3 seconds that I was describing a game that did not exist at all. It was definitely not the game they were making. And they were like, nah, it's really just shoot Nazis. We want, like, you know, and I can't even remember which one it was. So I don't remember who they ended up hiring. And I don't know if they were even seriously considering me because I literally effectively had only Flo to my name. So it would have been a massive gamble from their point of view to hire me. But I happen to know this guy who was a producer on the game who was evangelizing pretty hard for me. So anyway, it was one of those where it was a little glimpse of that game could be interesting. A game, a World War II game about a kid who's thinking about home but, you know, that's not really. In fact, funny enough, the one that Will Roget did, when they went back to World War II was the only one ever that they actually kind of had that. There were all these flashbacks that they put in the game as playable moments and as cinematics of a kid growing up learning to hunt and learning to use a rifle and stuff like with his dad or whatever it was. I don't remember the specifics, but I remember going, hey, at least this idea somehow someone else thought of something vaguely adjacent to this idea and did it, but without the sort of big band aspect, which would have been the really, you know, interesting and weird twist. But yeah, it was clear. Just have to set up my own, you know, competitor to freaking Treyarch. And
I mean, why not? Like, I'm just hearing that idea and it's fantastic. And like you said, like that Call of Duty, that most recent Call of Duty, it's like, okay, there were some really cool themes in there. But yeah, what you were talking about, that was literally 15 years before, you know, it feels like you've got some ahead of their time ideas in there.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, it was just an off the cuff, just thinking about what would be an interesting way to approach it. And like I said, I was very influenced by just thinking about the people that I had physically spoken to and just knowing that they were kids. They were barely not kids. And just thinking, well, what would a kid actually be thinking about, you know, right up until the day they get on the plane to go to, you know, basic training. But no, I don't claim to be ahead of the curve on anything there. I'm always daydreaming things. And to be clear, arguably that's a very non-commercially viable premise I'm pitching as well. It's like a World War II game that's really mostly preoccupied with what it was like growing up. Sounds like an excellent, an excellent indie game, but hardly a AAA level of stakes.
I'm actually already thinking about some precedent. Oh, I know Mike's having some connection problems. I'll let you go, Mike.
Am I audible?
Yes, you are.
Excellent. That's my favorite way to be. I think I was just making a general sound of sympathy, so didn't mean to derail you.
We like sounds of sympathy.
Sounds like a good song title. You know, Austin, you were talking about sort of imagining alternative pathways in your life and how decisions at key junctures kind of branched your possible future off into different directions. And speaking on that very theme, I was wondering if you'd like to talk a little bit about a game whose preview you delivered at GDC earlier this year kind of blew me away. And we alluded to it earlier in the episode, which is Stray Gods.
Well, I don't even know where to begin. I guess I told the origins of how I met the beginnings of the team.
But, yeah, I was wondering, maybe you could give us sort of like a big picture overview of the setting, the premise, characters, and so forth.
Oh,
and
sure.
Then we can dive into the musical aspect of it.
So the game's creative director, David Gator, is also the writer and the guy that sort of hatched all the premise of it. So I'm essentially giving you the David Gator cliff notes right now. But he... the story is it's a hybrid of a few different types of games in that it is highly narrative driven. It's not preoccupied with extraneous mechanics in any sense. It's really just solely focused on narrative. I jokingly said, imagine playing Dragon Age and getting rid of everything other than the dialogue trees, and then adding musical numbers, I guess. So we've got it's a narrative focused game in which the character plays this young woman named Grace, who is sort of drifting in life and doesn't really know what she wants to do. She's kind of just lost and aimless. And randomly one night, she and her band are hanging out, and this young woman comes in. They have a moment of kind of connection. And then they part company. A few hours later, there's a knock on the door. Grace opens the door. This young woman collapses into her arms, essentially, with a fatal wound and dies in front of her. And there's a big flash of light. Someone shows up and says, hey, you got to come with me, and brings Grace before what she discovers is effectively the remnants of the pantheon of Greek gods who have are real, have been living kind of in hiding, but more or less among us for the last several thousand years, led by Athena. And the person who had died was Calliope, the last of the muses, and they think you did it, and basically say, you've got a week to prove your innocence before we execute you. And the twist, or the kind of kicker, is that the power of the muse is this ability to kind of essentially instigate musical numbers as a way to find the truth. And the big flash that had happened when Calliope died was that her Eidolon, you know, the source of her power, was passed along to Grace. So this one of the things that we talked about when I first met Liam and David was how, you know, we said, well, so what are some of your favorite musicals? And we both kind of sheepishly at first admitted that the season 6 episode of Buffy, the Buffy musical, is one of our absolute all-time favorite musicals, not least of which because it's a rare example of a fully diegetic musical. It's one in which it is narratively woven in that they know they're in a musical, and figuring out a way out of the musical is the whole point of the story. They'll die if they can't escape it. But the musical, because songs by their nature, especially the way they're used in musicals, are all about honesty and the fact that you say your feelings through song a lot more easily than you do through spoken normal dialogue, that they become this window into the soul. And the genius of the Buffy musical was that, you know, that show would have these long character arcs that span multiple episodes and even multiple seasons. And there were some really major character revelations that they decided to reveal through the musical. So this episode that could have easily been seen as just like, it's a little side venture, it's a fun little aside that's not really the main point of the show, and we don't want to give it any real narrative stakes on where we're going with our story. No, they did the opposite. You know, Buffy reveal in particular, they all do, but Buffy's big revelatory song at the end of that episode is like this devastating piece of information that is just horrifying to her friends that she's been hanging on to as a secret for like 12 episodes in a row, and they've been trying to ask and figure out what's wrong with her, and they use that episode as the way to reveal it. And I just always thought the creative courage to have your show that's, you know, it's an action show, it's a teen drama, it's a coming of age sort of allegory, and to do something as hokey and ridiculous, and at that time totally unprecedented, as a full musical episode, and then to put such narrative stakes on it was amazing. So we bonded over that immediately, Liam and I in particular, and David, and we said, you know, the idea that this could be a diegetic musical, that this character of Grace is sort of given this supernatural power where she can't force people to do things, but she can sort of summon a musical number that in which they will be honest with her, opens up some interesting storytelling and gameplay ideas. And that's where, you know, that's where we were 5 years ago. And then it was like, okay, how the hell do we do that now? It took us 5 years to come up with an answer.
Well, you anticipated one of my first questions was whether the songs are diegetic versus purely narrative. But that's clearly you've made a hard decision towards the characters being aware that they're singing. Another question that leapt to my mind is to, you know, if you think of a traditional musical, we bond with the main character or the main characters because we feel that through their song, they're conveying something we connect to. And in a game, rather than bonding with the main character, you're taking ownership of the main character.
Right.
So in this case, does your avatar, does your representative in the game, does she do the bulk of the singing, or is it the people that she is magically interrogating?
It's both. She, you know, Grace, Laura Bailey is the actress who's just, I could never say enough positive things about, what a trooper. Every song is to some degree a duet or trio or quartet of she plus somebody else. The main kind of narrative parameter of these songs are, like you said, it's actually kind of, I've never used the term interrogation, but they kind of are that. They're not cleanly that necessarily each time, but they have a version of that in common, sometimes explicitly, sometimes it's a little bit more kind of subtly. And of course, being that David of many years running BioWare acclaim, there is a whole separate notion of optional romanceable characters that's a secondary consideration, which means that there are, of course, romantic songs. We have four different optionally romanceable characters. So you have, you know, a bunch of songs that you will not hear on a given playthrough, depending on the choices you make there. And of course, there's also contingencies for if you romance nobody. So we are, the way I've been explaining, especially to folks who know what I'm talking about in terms of dynamic audio, like this crowd, we are interactive a variety of ways. So sometimes it's a decision that you make early in the game will just remove things from the playlist, as it were, downstream without you having even realized it. You know, like, for example, there's a moment where two characters are fighting and you have to kind of intervene and pick a side. Well, both of those characters are optionally romanceable, and whoever side you pick, the other is now not romanceable in this playthrough. So that will immediately take those songs out of the equation for this playthrough in a way that you'd have to start again to reverse. So that's like the slow motion kind of interactive audio system, because it's sort of taking whole chunks out of the system. It's not something happening in real time, but we also very much have real time interactive music happening in a very kind of branching narrative sense. But all that said, something that you asked, the way you were framing your question about the difference between watching an audience, as an audience member watching something in a theater or on a screen, and kind of projecting our empathy based on what they present to us, as contrasted to a game where that empathy is engendered by our kind of co-ownership in their choices.
Exactly.
To varying degrees, obviously. You know, some games don't really give you much agency, but by virtue of making you hit the square yourself, you feel like you chose it, even though, you know, it's like, well, the alternative was to turn the game off or hit a fail state. You know, like The Last of Us is always my favorite example of that, where it's a game that you end up empathizing with the character precisely because you can't do anything but what he would do. And I always loved that they create a character that is of moral fiber so different from my own, and they give me zero agency because it's not about role-playing as me through his filter. It's role-playing him and taking on his morality. And that's a very different from, you know, an open-ended RPG or something where the character is little more than a blank canvas. We're kind of in between those, because Grace is very much a person with a personality, but our branching system is built around traits, which are kind of like different shades of the same impulse, or the different shades of the same person. And we have them color-coded as red, green, and blue, where red is kind of the antagonistic, green is sort of the compassionate, empathetic, and blue is the sort of cerebral or intellectual, or depending on the situation, it might be conniving and strategic. And so the idea is essentially, you can think of it as like the head, the heart, and the gut. It's if I get in your face and yell at you, I can get right back in your face. You could get right back in my face, rather, and fight fire with fire. That would be red. You can take a step back and try to ask yourself, well, why would this person be doing this, and kind of search for empathy? Or you can go, well, I'm betting that the reason they're yelling at me is because, you know, their lover left them, and they're lashing out at me, and I can leverage that, you know, and or whatever. So you have three, the same person is capable of equally arriving at any of those. It's kind of, what is your mood in this moment? How did that specific thing that they said make you feel? And you respond accordingly. So that's sort of how it's structured, because what that means is that Grace, all of these things, like when we're working on these songs and writing all these just endless piles of lyrics and everything, you know, we would always have to check with David and say, this is in fact something she would say, right? Even at her most angry or her most compassionate or what, these all still fit believably under this umbrella of who Grace is. And likewise, all the other characters in the game. And that was a constant source of negotiation, you know. It was like, well, are we pushing right to the edge of what we think their personality would viably be like? And because we want the player to have maximum amount of agency here, but obviously not so much so that Grace ceases to exist as a character.
So you're steering yourself through this possibility space while trying to remain true to the character at every turn from your standpoint as game developers. And what are the musical implications of your choices. I seem to remember that there's, as you travel through the branches and you make choices of a certain emotional, moral tenor, that the music itself starts to adapt to the nature of your choices. Assuming that memory is correct, could you describe that?
So it was every song tackles this a little differently because they're all specific to whatever's the narrative point of that song. Because these songs are not sort of generically modular. They're very much a scenario you've entered into with a specific goal. And so everything is derived from that. So, for example, one of the songs is a kind of Cyrano de Bergerac-esque comedic bit where a character is trying to woo another character but has no idea how to do it. He feels totally lost. So he's asking you to use your muse power to essentially guide the moment and give him advice. So that's one of our few like overtly kind of silly bits in the game, and it's quite there's some bits in there that I think are very funny. But that one is also, as a result, it's comparatively very simple because the narrative function of that scene is pretty cut and dry. Another scene, for example, branches just to outrageous degrees because there are so many downstream potential consequences. And also, this is a major character that we're introducing, and we need to kind of give a lot of opportunities to see them through all these different lenses because it's going to be somebody that we're traveling with for the whole rest of the game. So it always had to be sort of bespoke. That's just sort of the premise of how to actually answer your question, because the sort of meat and potatoes of it, or the nuts and bolts of it, as it were, are, I realized that, yes, of course, the color coding helps the player get a sense of, okay, I get the idea of the temperament that I am responding with at any given moment, you know, aggressive, compassionate, clever, or conniving, or whatever. Those are pretty legible concepts, I think, without a lot of onboarding or tutorializing or anything. Like, it's different than the typical BioWare, or like you think of Mass Effect with Paragon versus Renegade, or Knights of the Old Republic, very obvious sort of Sith versus Jedi. We're not putting moralistic value judgments on these the way that does. We're not saying, do you want to be good or evil? We're saying, what mood are you in? All of these are moral equivalents. And at least we are trying to make them. So you might subjectively feel differently, but we're not espousing that this one is overtly this versus that. So it becomes a, how do we make it so that the player really tracks the differences here? Well, obviously on a basic level, just the songwriting has to do that. Like if I click red with the intention that it be aggressive, the song should sound aggressive now, just by in response, because David has this wonderful term he calls doing card tricks in the dark, which is when game mechanics, when you invite the player to do a thing for which they see no noticeable output. You know, it's like if I can change the trait, but the song appears to be unmoved by that, I don't really know for a fact I've done anything. And so he was always obsessed with, you know, let's make sure we're not doing that. And I became very obsessed with this idea. So, for example, it had to fit narratively. So in the case of one of the songs, like there's one in particular where we just really went absolutely ballistic on this, where every time you hit red, it turns into borderline a rap battle. But if you hit green, it's like this lush, almost romantic thing with strings, and it's diametrically opposed genre wise in a way. And one of the fun things is, well, what if a player goes red and then green, or green and then red? We have to be able to cross pollinate these so that if you're sitting there with your eyes closed, it just sounds like you're listening to a linear song. It should never feel like someone's playing Mad Libs and just inserting little bits within a thing that's otherwise pre-configured. One of my little kind of guiding lights while working on it was, if someone's in the corner not watching but they're listening, they should be shocked to discover that this was interactive, because it should just sound like a succession of musical numbers.
This sounds like an absolutely massive amount of recorded audio content. Like, how did you manage all of that?
As you know, all three of you would be very hip to the fact that there's no clever workaround, really. It's just a brute force. I mean, when all was said and done, my final deliverable of just raw audio bits was well over 6 hours of material. And generally speaking, we averaged about anywhere from 4 to 6 to 1 as our ratio of material that exists versus what you will hear in a given playthrough of a song. So basically, on average, anywhere from like 12 to 18% of the music viably within a song is what a given playthrough will yield. But the thing is, it's not like you could then play it. If it say it was 20%, 5 playthroughs would not actually yield a comprehensive overview of all 5, because it's not 5 versions of the song. Their branches are every few seconds. So there are places where we found ways to make branches reconverge and a few things like that, just to make it semi sensible. But generally speaking, you would have to play it very methodically. Sometimes it's literally dozens or even hundreds of times. And in the case of like the finale song, you would have to play it a lot more than that if you truly wanted to hear every configuration, because that one also does a bunch of vertical sort of stem rearrangement as well, where it's looking back at all your prior decisions through the whole game and aggregating them and saying, okay, so you've trended red, so we're going to tilt the whole song red, which means if you want to hear this song differently, you'd have to replay the entire game conscientiously differently from the start. So we do things like that as well, where, you know, there's interactive audio is sort of a compiling effect over the duration of it. To give you another sense of it, we recorded our cast over about 90 recording sessions. It took about 6 months, and it was awesome, but it was a lot. It was just a lot of spreadsheets and a lot of my notebook just full of endless notes to myself and thousands of markers and Pro Tools and Digital Performer.
it must have been incredibly complicated to maintain some kind of sort of vocal coherence and consistency if you're recording one segment and then it's going to branch off into a bunch of different directions. That must have been really challenging. But I'm really curious to hear how you would approach doing a soundtrack for such a thing. Like if somebody wanted to go and listen to a soundtrack of this game, as always with, you know, when we're doing music for games, the soundtrack is always a bit of a complicated puzzle when you've got dynamic reactive audio. But in this case, did you just choose a few sort of arbitrary threads through the whole game and say, okay, here's the soundtrack?
So this question haunted me for like 2 years, because I could see this problem coming. Because one of the things that was really important to us philosophically was to never canonize a given set of choices. Okay. We don't ever want to make it seem like you're allowed to do whatever you want, but the real Grace would have done this.
This is the correct one. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because that's what I think. Like, I just am obsessed with Mass Effect, for example. And I love getting into debates about the right choices in a Mass Effect playthrough with fellow Mass Effect nerds, you know? And I think that they did a really good job at making a lot of different mutually exclusive decisions feel very equally viable. You can't sort of have this milquetoast version of multiple things combined with a handful of the choices in those games. It really is like, are you A, B, or C kind of thing? And we aspire to that. You know, we wanted there to be some real dilemmas of, you know, oh my God, you know, because it's, you know, we settle major, again, inspired very much by musicals in general, but by particularly the Buffy musical. You know, I said major narrative dilemmas need to be borne out in these songs. They shouldn't happen in the moments in between songs where we're kind of pausing to sing about our feelings and then, okay, now what are you going to do about it? I said, let's make it a thing that happens in the song, you know, as often as it makes sense to, which is most of the time. And so that means that a soundtrack album is going to like you either just release this unintelligible smorgasbord of component parts, which, you know, you guys are probably the only three that would find that remotely fascinating because you would understand immediately, like looking at it, you know, you would kind of parse pretty quickly how it works. But even then, there's just so much shit that after 10 minutes of poking around, you'd be like, okay, enough of that. And you're the only three on the planet who could be the viable audience for a release in that way. So obviously there has to be some kind of curation. It's like you said, it's every soundtrack album, particularly for games, has this problem in a way that people, it's amazing to me how that is just, I've actually been working on a YouTube video specifically about this question, about the difference between writing a score and releasing an album and how sometimes they almost bear no resemblance to each other past the surface level. And folks, you know, I'm always told, oh, how long did it take you to write this track? And I'm like, well, let's just start with the faultiness of the premise of the question before we even begin to answer that, because this wasn't a track at any stage. And but anyway, all that aside, here's what I've landed on. I'm releasing four albums. So I realized it, here's the analogy I like to draw. Let's say I ask you to meet me at some address in a city, and you're over here and the address is over here. The path to getting there, there's literally essentially endless permutations of streets and highways and combinations that you could take to wind and weave your way there. That's a pretty good analogy for a given playthrough of the game. So the highways will ultimately not get you there because no address is on a highway. But they will give you if you take a highway sort of past it, you'll get an overview. So with that in mind, I thought, what if you played the game where every single time you hit red and a second playthrough where you hit green and a second blue, like dogmatically, you end up with this thing that's not really representative of what anyone's actual playthrough will be, but it does give you a kind of a taste test. So it's like imagining if your address is in the middle of the map and there's a triangle of highways around it. I thought, okay, so that's three albums right there where it's just like, here's each song, you know, just over and over and over, red, 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 red. Now, of course, even then, there are forks in the road, like within red or within green, where I had to just make a choice. Because it's not that simple even of, well, what do you do? And there's also moments where, for example, like I mentioned earlier, there's a moment where two characters are fighting and you have to pick a side. Well, that's not represented by color. So I thought, well, I think if I'm in a red headspace, I would pick this person, but that's fundamentally me making now a subjective call, but it's the best I could do. Same thing with the optional romances. I decided, well, there's four romanceable characters. There's four albums. I'll pick one romance thread per album. So now I have to kind of subjectively decide if I'm red, which character is likely to appeal to me. Well, that already, because there are red, green, and blue variations within the romance song. So I'm already boxing out some potentials by virtue of these choices, but I thought it'll give you a pretty reasonable overview, even though, ironically, I don't think any player will actually play the game like this. They're kind of missing the point if they do. Idea is to intermingle it all and see what that yields. I hope, at least, that's how it feels.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it sounds like you need a disclaimer on the soundtrack to say this music may not match what you have experienced in the game.
Oh, I have it already written on my Bandcamp for when I hit the button to release it, where it says none of these represent a definitive attempted definitive playthrough, because I created, like, on Spotify and all that, it'll be four separate albums, but on Bandcamp I decided like that's ridiculous, so I just made a single. It's like 90 tracks and it's over 4 hours of music that I kind of whittled it down to. So that gets me three of the four. And so then what I did is I then went and I said, okay, what did I miss? If I take all the different bits throughout all the songs that hitting pure red, pure green, and pure blue eliminates, that kind of puts me in a slightly narrower sort of lane to weave through. So then I went and said, okay, well, what are options within that? So that if some person was crazy enough to listen to all four, there'd be almost no overlap amongst all four, even though the fourth one is a deliberate bobbing and weaving. But in order to make sure that it never dips into the pure red or green paths, basically, it actually did give me a fairly finite number of remaining choices. There's still a lot left off the table, but I was actually surprised when I went through this exercise that across all four, it actually tells a fairly like massive caveat, but fairly comprehensive overview. But you would have to listen to all four to really experience that. I also, for the sake, like I called them the red edition, the green edition, the blue edition, and then the fourth one I called the Pantheon edition, because that's also where I put all the like underscore, because I had to write, you know, an hour and a half of score, you know, for all the dialogue scenes and whatnot between the musical numbers. And so I decided, well, I don't need to release. There are actually alternate versions of those. Like, there will be things where, you know, in the aftermath of a song, you're now in dialogue with the character you were just singing with, and whatever kind of the main riff that emerged as a result of your choices, now I want instrumentally kicking around in the score. So there are a lot of dynamic aspects where the score is looking to the songs to go, well, what version of the song did you end up sort of building? We want to reflect that in the score. So there is a lot of dialogue between them in that way. But the score is comparatively, especially compared to others I've done, it's actually one of the simpler scores. So I thought, okay, well, that'll be the fourth album will be kind of like the monster album that has all of the score. There's actually also, there's one song in the game that is actually just a linear song, which is the opening, like when they accuse you of the murder, they just sing this song that where they basically are saying, they call themselves the chorus, the kind of council of Greek gods. We think we are in agreement. The song is called The Chorus is in Accord. And they say, you know, we are in agreement that you committed this murder. And sorry, those are the rules. We didn't make them. And it's just a short little bit, but it's the first time that the character is kind of has this power and it's sort of happening in spite of her. She doesn't know how to control it. And so it's a sort of a reaction to that. And there are no variations because she hasn't learned yet that she has choice over this. That's the next sequence. And it's sort of where we do the classic gamey, we're sort of tutorializing to the player in tandem to the character. She's being told, you have this power, make choices effectively in the song. That's the one I showed at GDC. That's the Pan, where Pan shows up and gives her advice. So it was actually ironically that one little tiny song that's really just there for expositional purposes. That was the one that made me realize, well, I can't release the same literal audio on four albums. Like, won't Spotify like yell at me if I try to just keep releasing the same song and pretending it's something different, but it's not. So the only linear song in the game was the one that made me go, I guess I have to do multiple albums and one of them can be the kind of compendium that has a few things that are just fundamentally not on the rest. And then I thought, okay, well then that, in that case, the score will go on that. And you know, a few other kind of bonus bits that I just thought, well, there's no other home for them. So I'm just going to throw them on that one as well.
That's an excellent solution. And I think so few players, well, I mean, players probably shouldn't have to care how we go about making the soundtracks for games when the actual game music itself is all in segments and it's all dynamic. And I think very few players probably would notice what they're, I suppose, after for when you're listening to a soundtrack is just a vibe and the just remembering that experience of playing and just the ambience and the atmosphere and the emotions of the experience. And so that sounds like a very good compromise for what would have been a very, very tricky soundtrack to kind of conceive.
Yeah, my hope is that it kind of shines a light on this concept for the average player, where they, because this game obviously highlights interactive music as its foundational sort of marketing gimmick. And so and then all you have to do is be half present to play through the game, go look online and realize, oh, these soundtrack albums don't actually correspond precisely to, like, there will be overlap undoubtedly. I mean, there's a few choke points where no matter what you choose, you will hear certain things. So like they will realize this is a version of sorts of theirs. And then it might hopefully for some people out there be that first moment, that first light bulb going on of, I bet every game probably has a version of it. Like every composer has to deal with this It's just not normally forward-facing in the game design, but it's no less present. In fact, sometimes it's far more so. I remember David Housden talking about on Thomas Was Alone how it's so modular and procedural in how it's conceived that he basically just had to kind of arbitrarily make something that would remind players of their experience, but knowing that it is effectively impossible. The same thing with, I always loved what they did for Ape Out, where they effectively just played it and captured the audio, and it was like a live gig. I always thought that was an awesome, I was tempted to do something like that for this one. And we've thought about ideas along those lines that could be really fun. But I also thought, no, I should be somewhat methodical. And so, yeah, this was the solution that seemed to make sense.
Vince and Mike, when you've done projects before, how often, because actually this is quite timely because the project that I'm working on at the moment, I am actually thinking of the soundtrack as I'm, so the soundtrack and the way that it goes together is how I'm making the music for the game. And then I take the bits out of the soundtrack to put into the game. So actually jumping ahead of that problem and trying to solve the problem.
Preemptively.
Preemptively, yeah. Exactly. But like Vince and Mike, on the projects that you've been on, have you ever done this approach where you've realized that, okay, the soundtrack's going to be tricky, so I'll preemptively try and solve for that ahead of it?
Honestly, the soundtrack is one of those things where I've paid really quite little regard to in the moment.
Okay.
And if anything, I rely on other people to have that insight into how people are actually listening to this stuff. I mean, sometimes it's really interactive, really dynamic. Sometimes it's pretty linear. But I don't know, after a certain point, I feel like I can't really trust my own ears sometimes when it comes to listening to these things, and I need someone else. And it doesn't necessarily have to be another music or audio person. Maybe it's a designer or just someone who is really connected to playing the game, who really understands that. Because I think so many of the games that I've been working on lately, I feel like when writing the music, I'm in the music weeds there. And I don't have perspective sometimes. And sometimes I wish that I had more time so that I could have that perspective. But, you know, that's time and effort that sometimes is not there for me.
Yeah, I found concept artists are the best people to do that.
Yes,
job.
Yeah.
Because they are often, they're very removed from the technical and they're purely emotional, basically, in the visual sense. So they're often the best people to come in and weigh in on the music choices for context when you need that sort of external input from somebody who isn't necessarily a musician. The concept artists are always the people that I turn to. How about you, Mike? Have you ever preemptively written a soundtrack and then and then made it into a game with reactive music?
I would say the only aspect of the process for me, which is forward-looking, is if I have multiple possible approaches for a given cue, and they're equally valid, I will often lean towards the one that I think will make for a more rewarding listening experience out of the context of the game or film, as it may be. So in that sense, I'll say, you know, try to do something musically interesting, even if it's not strictly necessary, so long as it doesn't obviously disrupt what's going on. But I don't, beyond that general ethic, I don't model in advance the experience of listening to the soundtrack album. That is often I'm looking at a pile of tracks and cues and thinking, okay, how do I assemble this? Essentially the same process Austin was talking about for me on a much smaller scale.
I can definitely say that I've during recording sessions, I've preemptively recorded like endings and things that I know have no utility in the game, but because I just know that on the album, I'll be grateful I have them. And so, you know, as long as they're not eating up too much of your time and cost for a thing that is not truly the task at hand, like soundtrack albums are inherently a bonus. But I've definitely done that a bunch, you know, cues that are, I'm just certain that this is going to be how the track ends. I can just hear it, even though I haven't even started thinking about that process. you just kind of intuit this is going to make for a nice kind of like punctuating moment. And so I should probably end the thought, whatever bits I end up combining to do this. This just feels like a natural ending point. But it doesn't have an actual end. So I have to create one. I will often sort of, that's a way in which I'll think ahead. And also just big plus one to that point of having someone who's not you and ideally not even a musician come in and weigh in on this stuff, because ultimately, isn't that who all this is for? Like,
exactly.
You know, none of you are writing music for the rest of us. Like, no one of you is writing music with the primary listener intended as the rest of us here. And likewise for me, you know, any composer whose main drive is to sort of impress fellow composers is likely not making something as emotionally resonant as they could be, because it shouldn't require, there shouldn't be like barriers to entry for just listening to music. And so, but it can be hard. It can be impossible to get that perspective without somebody who's just has none of that baggage, or somebody who wouldn't go, oh, I kind of forgot what I was listening to because I heard this sound in the mix and I was just trying to figure out what is that sound? That was so cool. And they like stopped letting it sort of wash over them in an emotional way. They're dissecting it immediately, that kind of thing. So yeah, I find that objective sort of musically illiterate, I say lovingly, people are my best friend in that regard.
Yeah, that's, I think, sage advice for our art form in its entirety, really, because I often find that we've just finished up a recruiting session for an artist. We had 212 applicants, which is a whole other story. It's just gigantic. Anyway, in talking to a lot of these people, the candidates, you get the sense that in the game industry, we're very good at looking inwards into our art form. And this is this is also for musicians as well. You know, we tend to look inwards because obviously we're focused on doing the best that we can as in our respective fields. And in the same with game design and games in its entirety, we look inwards. So you look at game heritage, you look at game history, you look at classic games, you know, and all this. But getting that objective stimulus, whether it be from somebody who isn't a gamer or doesn't even play games, or even, you know, drawing your inspiration from things that are not games at all, which is something that I don't think happens enough, you know, just go to an art gallery or check out some architecture or read a book or like, you know,
couldn't
this kind
agree
of
more.
Stuff. I think that's something that, because we're also passionate about games, we tend to forget that we're just this little part of in this massive world of art, and there's so much inspiration to pull from all directions. So getting that objective stimulus, not only for music, but also for our art form in its entirety, I think is just really important. So well said, Austin.
I echo your point also of looking outward. I had a conversation recently with the game developer, creative director, Ken Levine. And I remember I asked him something like, you know, because he created BioShock, you know, he's the team creative director on BioShock and writer. And I said, you know, did you find yourself looking out at the kinds of stories that games were telling and actively sort of look for something that seemed to be not explored territory? And it was the opposite, to your exact point. He was like, no, I just was reading different books from other writers and was like fascinated by what kinds of situations yield sort of extremism from a philosophy, and how do you radicalize somebody? And, you know, he's like, I like reading books about history, and I like taking ideas and going, what happens when you stretch them to an absolute breaking point? Would defenders of that idea even still recognize it at that point? And so none of this is derived from, especially back then, what was going on really from other games. It was precisely because he was reading other kinds of books and he was fascinated by history and that he arrived at a thing like that. And I thought that's such a good sort of broad lesson for everybody, you know, put yourself in unfamiliar territory and see where it takes you. And intrinsically, sort of almost definitionally, anything games related is likely to be familiar territory on some level. And so now, of course, that said, I'm always an advocate for, you know, like when young composers say, do I have to be a gamer to score games? I'm always saying, well, technically no, but games are awesome. Why are you even asking this question? Like that question to me feels like it's this veiled attempt at going, it's like a high school teacher being asked, is this reading mandatory? Where you go, I mean, no, but what does it say about you that you're even asking? You know what I mean? I've always thought, why do you want to score games? Are you just looking for a paycheck? Like there are easier ways to get a paycheck than a medium that you're not even interested in. I would think, even as a composer, you know, I would think that's true. Like there's other ways to earn a living as a composer specifically. So yeah, I've always found that. So it's like I play a lot of games. I constantly am playing games, but it's also, yeah, it's important to go to concerts and read books and read poetry. And, you know, I have a friend who has an art exhibition that's closing this weekend that I'm going to try to go see his exhibition. You know, that's like to your exact point. Yeah. Go study art. One of the coolest things I ever had. I remember when I was at NYU, I was telling that story earlier, one of my high school friends, went to Cooper Union, which is a big architecture school right next door to NYU. And I remember she got a lot of insights into the architectural sort of goings on of Manhattan. And so one night she just took me on a walking tour through the village up all the way up into Midtown, just pointing out architectural features that I probably never noticed about all these different buildings and trends and styles. And you can tell this building is built around this time period because of this feature and that feature. And it was one of the most enlightening and amazing things ever, where you just think it's almost like reading tree rings, where you go, you learn so much about the heritage of this people just by looking at the window panes, you know? I mean, it was absolutely amazing. And you don't get that stuff unless you go looking for it, you know?
That's cool. And all of that goes in there and it will come out in some form somehow in your work in some way. So it's all valuable.
Yep. Yeah, yep,
couldn't agree more.
Definitely. I think that's part of the reason why we, before we close off the episode, because we've been going at it for more than an hour now, we like to talk about what we've been consuming lately. And you've obviously talked about some of that stuff there. Wow, that was making a lot of noise.
Yeah, what was that? It sounded like you were opening and closing a glasses case.
Yes. In fact, that was exactly what I was doing.
there's something about the like fiberglass, you know, and the specific impact velocity of those springs that's like the only thing in the world that makes that noise. It's very weirdly specific.
It's like I just wanted to get the cloth out so that I can clean my glasses. They just really need it. Yeah, like I was saying, we should talk about some of the things that we've been checking out lately. Let's see. Mike, what have you been checking out lately? Have you been watching anything interesting, reading anything interesting lately?
So one of my favorite fantasy authors is Daniel Abraham, and who you also may know as one of the two writers of The Expanse, which also happens to be one of my favorite TV shows. And he's come out with this new trilogy called the Kithamar Trilogy. And the first book is called Age of Ash. And what's really impressive to me, in addition to his just natural talent at writing and creating relatable characters in a pseudo-medieval fantasy world, is that he's come up with something that's structurally new, or at least I've never seen this done before with a fantasy series, where he's got three books. They all take place in the same city, and they all take place over the same year. And you're getting the same course of events from the perspective of different characters. So in some ways, it has kind of a video game-esque quality to it. But
Back to the Future 2, the whole sequence where it's sort of, you know, different angle on the same exact series of events.
You have literally read my mind, because that is the analogy I use for these books, where it is really deftly interwoven in the exact same way, where you feel like you're looking at, to use a movie metaphor, you're like looking at the same scene, but the camera is swiveled to another part of the room, and it's done really well. So highly recommend this for any readers of fantasy in general. And that's what I've been voraciously, in addition to conspicuously, consuming lately.
That's really awesome. What about you, Alex?
Unfortunately, I haven't been following our own advice here and doing things other than listening to music, but I've just got back from Australia, and I think I might have mentioned on the show before that my father is actually a classical church organist, a pipe organist. Mm. And so while I was in Australia, I had the opportunity to attend a few recitals. that's on the one side of it. The pipe organ, I think, doesn't get enough love just because it's such a complicated instrument, and it's very complicated.
It's very unwieldy.
Yeah, I think that the most recent example I can think of was probably our mate Zimmer's soundtrack for Interstellar. I think he had a pipe organ on that. The last time I can remember a pipe organ in the sort of mainstream is probably the song Closer to the Edge by Yes in 1970-something. If you know, there's like this massive crescendo that has a pipe organ in the middle of it. Anyway, so that's on the one side of the spectrum. On the other side of the spectrum, the last few days I've been really getting into, this is for research purposes, of course, because the soundtrack I'm doing at the moment actually needs this style, but early industrial music. So I think I mentioned Front 242 before. What I've been really enjoying the past few days is a group from the mid-80s and early and 90s called Nitzer Ebb, or Nitzer Ebb, from the UK. It looks like Nitzer Ebb, but it's pronounced Nitzer Ebb. And their album, That Total Age, from 1987, is seminal industrial music. Like, I believe it was actually referred to by a long-gone subgenre title of electronic body music.
Wow. EBM. Never heard that term.
Yeah, EBM. So anyway, That Total Age, 1987, Nitzer Ebb. Excellent. Absolutely excellent. And I've just been sort of deep diving into that and trying to find interviews about how they got that sound and the synths they use and just sort of the philosophy behind that texture of early industrial music. So that's me.
Wow.
I guess we'll leave our special guest to the end. So how about you, Vince? What have you been conspicuously consuming?
Oh, man. Arcade games? Well, I was in Japan recently, so I had to check out some game centers. And I was really happy to see a fellow musician's game in one of those arcade game centers in Japan. Actually, there was one in Tokyo. There was one in Kyoto. He wrote the soundtrack for this game called Donut Dodo, which is basically a modern take on an 80s game, like 80s pre-Nintendo. You know, the whole idea of those Atari games of the late 70s, early 80s, everything's contained on a single screen. There's complexity in the movement of these individual actors on the screen, but that's really about it. But it's like the ultimate version of that type of old school 80s platforming game. And really great action, really great refinement of that old school gameplay. But also, Sean just did a really fantastic soundtrack that is totally accurate to the capability of the game hardware at the time, and it's beautiful for it because you can hear how well he works with and around the limitations of the hardware. It's just a really wonderful game and a really, really wonderful soundtrack. It's honestly kind of awe-inspiring, that type of not just retro style soundtrack, but really lovingly crafted genre soundtrack there. So I really recommend it. Donut Dodo.
Was that all done on period authentic hardware, or was it more emulation?
He was doing it in trackers, so it was definitely rendered out in a more modern way with WAV files, but he was doing it with the limitations of the time really being there, since he was using those trackers.
Right.
Yeah.
I approve.
I knew you would like that, Alex. What about you, Austin? I know you've talked a little bit about some of this stuff, but...
Yeah, I'm always all over the place in terms of what I'm reading and seeing. I've been going to a lot of concerts lately. We've kind of hit Hollywood Bowl season.
Oh yeah,
here in LA. So I'm going again tomorrow. They're doing a 90th birthday tribute to Quincy Jones that I decided to get some excellent seats for because I thought this is a one off if ever there was one. And he's just such a
A legend.
Definitely one of my heroes. Yeah, mm-hmm. He, just so forward thinking. The stuff that he was doing, and you go and you're like, that was in the 60s? it was just mind-blowing creative insights. And the fact that he's still around is I just think it's awesome. So that's like, you know, and like I said, I got a friend whose art exhibition is that afternoon. So I think I'll probably end up going to a gallery and then from there to the bowl. And also, when you were talking about that trilogy of game of books from the I forget his name, but the Expanse guy, the half of Daniel the Expanse Abraham. Team. Daniel yeah. Abraham. If you ever played the game Tacoma, Fulbright's game that they did after Gone Home, it kind of flew under the radar compared to the huge success of Gone Home. But it has a narrative shtick. This is from a few years ago, so it's hardly a thing I'm consuming now, but I loved this game because I had never experienced narrative this way. And it's basically a real-time version of what you described with that book, if you've not played it, where you're on a space station that's abandoned and they have these holographic security recordings that you hit play. And so you'll be like in a room and two people will come walking in the room already talking, and then they'll kind of hush themselves and they realize there's other people in the room. And the game lets you do things like, well, what if I restart the recording, but I go back to wherever they were walking in from, and I can track their conversation separately, you know, now that I see where they're coming from. You know, you start the recording again, you go down that hallway, you walk with them, and you're playing the scene from multiple angles. Or somebody says, hey, you know, I gotta go, and they leave, and you follow the recording of them to their room. And so this thing is all happening in real time. You have to watch it multiple times in order to kind of follow different threads. I thought it was the coolest way to tell a story. It sort of took the BioShock or System Shock audio diary idea as a way to kind of tell a story after the fact and add this wrinkle to it that I thought was so fascinating and cool. Otherwise, I think the game that I've played the most aggressively lately was when I saw that Darkest Dungeon 2 was coming out. I was like, shit, I never actually finished the first one. So I played the first one top to bottom, forgot how freaking hard that game can get. And then I started the second one, and then I realized I should have just looked on Steam. The second one is so different from the first that it's almost it's almost like deceptive to call it Darkest Dungeon 2. It has essentially only character design superficialities in common, but it is a fundamentally different game. I mean, I guess the combat mechanics are similar, but it's just so different that I was like, I didn't need to spend 30 hours replaying the first one in order to play the second one, because I was just trying to, you know, remind myself, and I hadn't read anything. And I've got Final Fantasy 16 queued up at home, but I haven't actually launched it yet. I'm a little hit and miss with the Final Fantasy franchise in general. And I've definitely been more miss lately. So, and just like broadly speaking, massively sprawlingly long games, I have to be careful about, because they come at the expense of so many other games as a reason that I, you know, I kind of have to be super judicious. But that one's been, other than that, two books I can recommend. One I finished a few months ago. It just came out earlier this year, called The War on Music, which I thoroughly loved and I love evangelizing for. It's written by a conductor named John Maucheri, who has a long and storied successful career as a conductor. And he decided, you know, why is it that sort of, in particular, academia just decided against music that audiences were loving? What is the origin of why there was such a split between so-called kind of academic music and so-called mainstream music in a way that had no real precedence in the whole history of civilization until the 20th century? And he tries to unpack that and gets into the geopolitics of it and the way World War II was so defining and all that. It's a great book, because he's a guy that, you know, he's equally at home conducting John Williams as he is Mahler, and he's done immense amounts of both. He was Leonard Bernstein's kind of assistant slash sort of backup conductor for like almost 20 years. And so he has a real love of all things so-called pop culture, but he's a deeply sort of literate classical musician. So anyway, his book, I thought it was an amazing kind of primer on this stuff. And right next to it, a book I've only just started by one of my former professors at USC, John Burlingame, has written a book called Music for Primetime about the history of television music, which is sort of this often looked overlooked sort of, it's like always considered sort of the bastard child of film music and sort of the automatically inferior sort of step down. And he sort of rejects that premise and offers a look at the history of it. And I bought it and I just haven't really gotten into it yet, but it will be the thing I dive into next.
Man, I'm going to buy those two books, actually, because those sound exactly like what I need right now. I've been looking forward to something else to add to my bookshelf.
I bet you'll, especially the War on Music, I bet you'll find very fascinating. I think it'll hit a lot of your particular interests, just knowing, as somebody who's cut across pretty much every dimension that book talks about, you know, as someone who has taught in a university, has worked on massively popular, sort of thoroughly what we would call mainstream things with a populist sensibility, I would argue. Like, you really have seen angles of all the different sides of this. I think you would especially find it fascinating.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. I am clicking the buy button.
John,
yes,
will be so happy.
I am doing it now. I am doing it now. Bam.
Good evangelizing. Go. Very effective.
Yep.
Matt Cherry, he's a dear friend, and but I read the book and just was like, independent of knowing him, I found it very well written, and it's deep enough for a professional musician to find it interesting, but it's comprehensible enough that you don't need any kind of professional musical insights. It's very readable for anyone. In fact, I think that the less you know about music, the more revelatory it's likely to be, and probably even more interesting as a result. Because I would say, you know, 80% of it I had read in one place or another. I just hadn't read it all as one narrative. He takes a lot of things that I'd read fragments of from other books and kind of cohesively packages it all into a pretty tight, straight sort of through line that it was great.
Oof. Okay.
So, anywho, well, thanks guys so much for having me. It's so fun to be able to talk. I've done a few interviews recently about Stray Gods, but they're always with not people like you who I have to kind of mark how much into the weeds I get on it. I have to speak in kind of broad overviews, or I just know it'll get cut from like the article or whatever. So I'm grateful to be able to kind of get into it a little bit more meatily with y'all who actually know this stuff. It's exciting.
Yeah, I think it's, well, I'm really excited to play the game as well, because as of the time of this recording, it's just less than 2 weeks. It is actually just a little over 1 week now. So I'm super excited to check it out.
It's actually, it's 13 days. August 10. We were going to be August 3. And then when Baldur's Gate moved up to August 3, we were like, well, to hell with that. We all want to play Baldur's Gate, so let's move ours a week later. I'm obviously joking, but only partially. You know, the goal was to there were enough 11th hour cert things that we were like, a week would actually be pretty helpful.
that always helps. Okay, so well, with that, let's give this episode the capstone that we typically give these shows. So this was episode 247 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we will post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I ask about whether I should have bought this as a hardcover instead of the Kindle version. I'm regretting it because I just immediately popped it onto my Kindle, and then the hardcover is only like $20. Oh, maybe maybe I should have done that.
I bought it as an Audible, and then after I finished listening to it, I just bought the hardcover. That's what I always do. When I listen to a book that I really love, I then just buy it as a totem of my love of it. So, and if it was only okay or whatever, I didn't finish it, I don't buy it physically.
Okay, well, it sounds like this is going to be more than okay. I'm going to have fun with this. Yeah.
Vince, you know that you're gonna have to change the end spiel to say the X verse now, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, oh, right. Whatever. I'll deal with that. I'll just leave that in there. It's still... Actually, I think my phone still has that Twitter logo.